Welcome to episode 20 of New in Tech People. Today we've got Ryan Stevens from Bohemia Interactive Simulations. Really interesting to hear from Ryan about the software that his team is creating, helping military across the globe. I hope you all enjoy the episode and get some further insights into another local Newcastle success story. Welcome to episode 20 of New in Tech People. Today we've got Ryan Stevens from Bohemia Interactive Simulations. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, James.
Bohemia Interactive Simulations, I think there's not too many people, know the ins and outs of what you guys do. Obviously, a really cool story in Newcastle, but we'll go into that in a sec. But if for the people that don't know of you, could you give us a quick overview of where you've come from, who you are, what you do?
Sure. Might take a while. I've kind of had a convoluted path to where I am now. So my background, and I'm still practicing, is as a lawyer. So I'm a commercial lawyer. I specialize in intellectual property. And obviously I'm English. I grew up in England. I trained in England. And the early part of my career was in London. And I had an interest in the law as it relates to film and television.
Yeah.
Actually, when I was at law school, I didn't really know which area of law I wanted to go into. The sort of big corporate end of things didn't really attract. But I did an elective in media and entertainment law, and that got me interested in the possibilities of working with sort of creative, in the creative industries in film and TV. And I managed to score, it took me a little while after I got out of law school, but I managed to score a junior sort of entry-level position with a TV production company in London. And so the early part of my career was as a commercial lawyer in the film and TV world. I moved to Australia in 2002 and carried on that path. I had a stint working for the ABC in their legal department, with working with Southern Star Endemol as well, working on things like Big Brother and Blue right. Heelers as their production lawyer. So that was an interesting time. And then I went into private practice, so working as in a boutique law firm in Sydney that did a lot of work around intellectual property, film and TV financing. Yeah. But at that time, we were picking up technology clients as well, because the principles around the sort of creation of IP, creation and the protection and exploitation of IP in film and TV, the underlying principles are very similar when it comes to technology and software. So we picked up a lot of technology clients, and I started to work in that area. One of the clients we picked up was a small company out of Anna Bay at the time.
Yeah, right.
Called Bohemia Interactive. And so I was their external lawyer for some years, nearly 3 years, I think it was. And but in the end, they grew to a size where they felt that they needed some legal expertise in-house.
Yeah.
And offered me a job. So I jumped ship. And that was in 2010.
Yeah.
So I've been with Bohemia Interactive for nearly 10 years now.
Wow.
9.5 years.
So from practice to internal.
That's it. Yep.
Nice. And then your role's changed from when you started to come in from that external to internal, but it's grown from there, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm still the group general counsel.
Yeah.
So I still wear that legal hat. But I also now run the company's operations for Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So we have our office out at Williamtown in the new buildings there next to the hotel.
Yeah.
We've got a team of 14 in Australia. And so I run the Australian operations, and that also makes me sort of head of sales for Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah. Head of sales, managing director, head legal counsel.
Yeah.
Just three small hats to wear.
That's right. There's not enough hours in the day, really.
No. So, mate, for people that don't understand, what do you guys do?
So, Bohemia Interactive Simulations, at our essence, we take computer game technology, and we repurpose that technology to provide training tools for the military. That's at the essence of what we do. So our flagship product is a product called VBS3, Virtual Battlespace 3. It is built on top of the game engine that was used in the Armor series of games.
Yeah.
So for those that know Armor on the gaming side, from a Czech company, Bohemia Interactive Studio, hence the Bohemia. So in our early days, in the fledgling days, we were very closely aligned with the entertainment company. We're separate now. We separated off at the end of 2012.
Yeah.
So we're a completely separate business now, but we still maintain links with the gaming studio. So our main product that's used by soldiers or warfighters is based on the tech from that underlies the Armor series of games. But with various tools and extra content and different functionality built on top of that by us. But the core of that is still game-based technology.
Yeah, right. So what's your team look like? You've got 14 in Australia. What's a team look like there?
So we've got a mixture of technical staff and non-technical. On the non-technical side, we have admin and finance people, sales and business development.
Yeah.
On the technical side, we've kind of got a microcosm of the rest of the organization. So we've got, we have a couple of programmers, software engineer, graphic artist, QA analysts, and customer technical support. So we've kind of got one or two of every main technical function that exists in our business sitting as a team in the Australian office.
Yeah, nice. And then what's the growth path look like for you guys? So obviously you've come from a place where there's a game house inside, and then you've split from there. What's the future look like? Are you continuing sort of down your current path? Is there future growth from there? International? What's growth look like for you guys?
So we're already pretty international.
Yeah.
When our company came along in the sort of mid-2000s with this offering of using computer game-based technology to train soldiers, it was truly disruptive.
Yeah.
That paradigm of training defense personnel didn't really exist. So the main use case for our product is in what are called battle simulation sites or battle simulation centers, which are just big computer labs. And they may have sort of 150, 200 computers. And they're bringing cohorts of trainees. They each sit at a desktop computer, control their avatar in the virtual environment, and go through tactics, techniques, procedures, mission rehearsal, communications, drills. So that's the sort of core use case for our product, and has been for many years. And we, by coming along with what we were able to offer, we kind of created that way of training soldiers. Yeah. And that's fairly widely accepted now, as most Western militaries will use our product in that manner.
Will the growth in that space come from VR and AR?
Definitely. That's one area where it's sort of extending out into different ways of using the tech.
Yeah.
So we've, as soon as there was that sort of mass market explosion of VR headsets, we had to respond to that because our customers were saying, what about VR? What about VR?
Yeah.
We're also now doing a fair bit of work with blended reality or mixed reality.
Yeah.
We've got a combination of real world inputs and virtual inputs, things like cockpit trainers, like procedural training in the cockpits of helicopters and aircraft.
Yeah.
That's a big application. So you kind of see that technology being extended out into different use cases because the new...
Same core product, but then just using newer technologies to, I guess, continue to advance and become better products, right?
Yeah. Our customers are pretty good at taking our stuff and saying, wow, I can do that with it, and taking it in new directions. So, and then we follow where they're leading, and we have to might implement new features or support for VR headsets and things like that to support what they're doing.
Nice. That's a fair old change from coming through, an entire career in law through to, managing a company in this space. How have you found that change? How have you found that change from, I know you're still wearing that law hat, the legal hat, but to now, I guess, in a pure software sense, how have you found that change?
When I look back on it now, I realise actually it was a pretty steep learning curve.
Yeah.
I guess when I was in the middle of it, coming into the industry, I was just doing it and learning as I went and making mistakes and going into meetings not always feeling like I knew the subject matter very well. But yeah, that's how you learn, I guess. So I had to learn both the tech side of what I was dealing with, and then also defense procurement is a whole beast in itself, in terms of military jargon and acronyms, and just learning how defense personnel think and understanding what their needs are and where they need to get to. Because you're coming in trying to sell them a product or some services, you need to understand where they've got to get to and how they think, what they need to achieve. So that's been that's been a big learning curve, but I've enjoyed it. It's, you know, it's given me a challenge pretty much every day I come into work.
That's great.
That's good.
I guess you, well, you're not, you're definitely not the only person, but there's probably a growing number of people now that are, you know, let's call them non-technical to start with, and then, you know, now involved with technology. Technology is obviously used to be pegged away in a section of the business, and technology now touches nearly all parts of a business on a day-to-day basis, but to manage that, that's a big responsibility and something that wouldn't be quite traditional back in the days, right? For a software development company, their head, their managing director to not be technical, right?
Sure. I mean, the need for me to be technical goes to a certain level. I'm not leading those technical teams.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not tasking them. I'm not running the stand-ups or
I'm
not in the Jira tasking or anything like that. So my understanding of the technical level needs to be sufficient for me to speak to our customers knowledgeably.
Yeah.
So the idea that I'm knowledgeable technically would make the guys back at the office laugh, I think. But my knowledge needs to be, you know, that layer on the top where I can talk knowledgeably to people who are knowledgeable about the solutions that we're offering.
Yeah.
But do I need to understand code, or do I need to understand development, software development methodologies in detail? No, I don't. But you know, there's still been a challenge there for me to understand concepts and ideas of technology. Otherwise, you can't speak to customers knowledgeably. They won't have, they won't feel you've got credibility. They won't have faith in what you're talking to them about.
I make no different in my role. I recruit technology professionals. I don't pretend to be able to code on a daily basis. I don't pretend to be as good a developer as any of the developers I work with, but I need to know what they do, how that works, and the differentiators between something that's good and bad. But I don't pretend to, you know, do what they do, right?
No. that would be foolish.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in what they do. I'm sure you are.
100%. And the more I learn, the more interested I get, the better I think I am at my job, right?
Because
the more I know about what they do in detail, the more I can help differentiate, the more intelligent conversations I can have. If you don't have an interest in it, I think you'd struggle to do well in probably your role or mine. If you don't have any interest in that technology side of things, it'd be pretty difficult, right, to be enthralled in that on a daily basis.
And
whilst you're not in the stand-ups, you've got to have knowledge of how are they building that if you're talking to a customer.
Sure.
Okay, this is something we can do. Otherwise, awesome. This is something we definitely couldn't do.
Yeah. Yeah, there's only so long a customer will tolerate you saying, I'm not sure, I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah.
You can do that sometimes.
I'm exactly the same. I don't pretend to know what I don't pretend to know.
Yeah.
There are some things that you have to be, let me get back to you. Yeah. But you've got to have a solid enough knowledge. And for your team, you don't want to be out there talking to customers and throwing them in the deep end. Oh, yeah, we can do this. And overpromise, right?
Yep.
Oh, nice. Well, I think that will be a growing trend as well, is that, you know, that really software teams and technical teams being managed by obviously non-technical people as well. You have to have that technical knowledge, but to manage a company like that, that's probably not the core deliverable, right?
No, I think the days where technology in a business was like the IT crowd guys in the basement, locked away. Oh, they're the tech guys and we're the business. That line's got to blur because technology...
It definitely has blurred. Technology touches all parts of business, and if it doesn't, a business might be in a bit of trouble. If not right now, definitely in the future.
Yep.
And the more senior technical people, or more senior technology people, are the people that are blending technology and business, right?
Yeah.
The people that are succeeding in managerial is that technology and business.
Okay.
How can technology influence business? What are our business goals and how can technology help us get there?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think as opposed to, you know, this is our business, feed it to the tech guys and, you know, let them do the thing.
Yeah,
if it's not a true partnership, significant problems can happen, right?
Yeah.
How do you see the, you know, the rise of technology or the different changes in technology, whether we're talking VR, AR, anything else influencing the future of Bohemia Interactive?
So the XR technologies are extending us in different directions. Something that's big and on the sort of immediate horizon is the way that we deliver our solutions, or the way that our customers deliver the virtual simulation training tools to their trainees.
Yeah.
So for sort of graphics intensive applications like ours, cloud delivery, true cloud delivery, delivery, you know, it's a sort of thin client, has been a challenge.
Yeah.
A bit of a holy grail, and it's getting closer. And we're seeing some of our more advanced customers really pushing hard in that direction now so that they can, you know, instead of having to deliver out large software builds to every point of need and terrain, virtual terrain is a big issue in military training, and how that's compiled, how realistic it is, how it's delivered is a big challenge. And so there's a big push towards having kind of like a central point of truth for our customers and pushing out the actual end training tool to the trainees via the cloud. So, you know, in the end, in a true sort of thin client manner, even if they're just starting with actual delivery of the tools by cloud distribution. So that, it's a lot of effort going on in that area at the moment because our customers are pushing us hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. That's always good to be driven by the customers, right?
Yeah.
That's a good way. You know, their heightened expectations are a good thing if it forces you as a company to continue to grow and get better and deliver better to what their needs are.
Yep.
If we reverse back to you individually, you've come through that legal path. You've done a degree, obviously, from that law standpoint. So it might be, you know, different to technology professionals in general. But how do you find your degree? Obviously, it's vital to get into a law degree. Into a law career, you can't do that without a degree, which is a little bit different technology. But what's your thoughts on the importance of degrees in general?
I've got mixed feelings on this. I'm a big advocate of education for education's sake. I mean, I know I did a vocational degree because I had an interest in law. But the university experience for me was one that was really important. It was an environment that was challenging, but still sort of protected, that allowed a lot of exploration and, you know, for you to figure out, find a space to figure out who you are in that education environment. So I'm a big fan of that aspect of university education. I can see that perhaps four-year degrees it's difficult, I think, to sustain that kind of investment in education, both from a financial cost for students, because I did my degree I finished my degree in 95, and I was at the early days of student loans in England, and even I graduated with a significant enough debt, but people graduating today are going to be graduating with much bigger debts than I did, and I don't know how sustainable that is. So I wonder whether a move towards more broken apart learning, I don't know what the right terms are for that, but even through down to sort of micro-credentialing on stuff, I think there's got to be a shift towards recognising that kind of...
I completely agree. I think that's a future, my personal opinion at the moment, is that mixed domain between micro-credentials and formal degrees, or part thereof formal degrees, I think.
Yeah.
I think instead of sitting at a four-year degree, you might sit X amount or X parts of that degree in addition to some micro-credentials, and that becomes your qualification.
Mm.
I think that's more relevant to industry. I think industry, a four-year degree where you've have to do 20 mandatory courses, of which at least, let's call it, at least 30% aren't relevant to, you know, what you want to do in your career. It's probably not the way of the future. I think it's going to be that mixed domain with the future.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I hope.
Yeah, I think, in today's environment, I think, and particularly in the technology space, a big four-year degree just seems unnecessary. I don't know. It seems overly heavy.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned the financial burden. It's probably also the time burden, right? It's also like a four-year investment is very significant. Like time's becoming even more so of the essence.
Yeah.
And people want to get into it. People want to get their hands dirty. People want to be able to get their hands dirty these days, especially from a technical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Without a degree, you can develop a game at home. You can do something. You can learn that the development language to to build your own gaming content, not or games at home, without a degree. So people don't want to then sit in a four-year degree to then come out and be like, oh, now you're allowed to do it.
Yeah.
They've been allowed to do that, you know, while they're 15, 16, sitting at home.
Yeah, and look, in our recruitment process, it's certainly not the first thing we look for. Yeah. One of the first things we'll look for is portfolio work.
Yeah.
You know, what have you done? Have you run gaming projects? Have you run a mod in the past? You know, have you got a history of modding games? Because that's relevant to us, those kind of skills. A lot of our guys do have formal qualifications, computer science degrees or whatever it might be, but not all of them by any means.
Yeah. Mate, I love that point just there, because I'd love to sort of evolve on that a little bit. So when you are recruiting people, especially in that space, what are you looking for? You mentioned, you know, looking outside of just a formal degree, but what are people doing outside of, do they have a genuine interest in this? Can you expand on that a little bit? Because that aligns extremely close with my train of thought.
Right, yeah. So some of the things we'll look for is, as I say, what sort of game modding experience that people have got. Have they run a game mod? Have they created a game mod? Or on the artist side, let's have a look at their portfolio of work, you know. Are they using the same tools that fit into our pipeline? Have they got skills in those tools that are demonstrated by portfolio work rather than formal qualifications? A lot of our technical staff have military interests.
Yep.
So they're military enthusiasts.
Yep.
Or they're ex-military, or they've been at least cadets or reserves.
Yep.
So they have some understanding of our customers' requirements and how our customers think and what they might be looking for.
Yeah.
You know, for example, when we produce some new content for the product, where perhaps it's a model of a particular rifle or a tank, when it's produced, you can guarantee there's a whole bunch of nerds, and I don't use that term in a derogatory fashion at all, who are going to point out to you that, you know, you've put the wrong variant on, or this particular tank doesn't have that decal on it, or you've forgotten the radio antenna that goes on the left back of the turret, or because our guys are knowledgeable, a lot of our guys are knowledgeable in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, nice.
So we're looking for, if someone's got one of those kind of skills, they're immediately interesting to us, and then we'll look at the rest.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I'm definitely of the opinion of hire for the person, not the skills. So if this person's got A, an interest in it, or B, shown some ability or the attitude to go out and do something on their own, I think that's, you know, whether they're doing some, you know, game mods on the side, whether they're doing something, they've got a genuine interest in what this role's going to do, that's different as opposed to somebody coming in for job's sake, right? Like, there's a very good chance if they've got a genuine interest in it, genuine interest in the end customer, they're going to pick up, you know, whatever development language they might need to. They'll pick that up along the way, and that's something that can be learned.
Yeah.
As opposed to that genuine interest, that can't be learned or taught. It's either you've either got that or you don't, right?
Sure.
So that's definitely something that I take into account in helping recruit.
Another thing is, and it's a bit of a cliche, but it is true, anything that demonstrates that people can work as part of a team.
Yeah.
Because we work in sort of small to medium sized development teams, which you know, using sort of agile methodology and working in sprints, that can be quite intense at times. So you need people who are going to be able to work collaboratively, work towards a team goal. So any evidence of that kind of aptitude is important as well.
Yeah, I completely agree again. I think I've got one of the better recruits I think I've made as a guy who's now managing pretty sizey team, and he come from a sporting background where he's, you know, he's a club captain, he's you know, you've got that embedded with him. He's a leader, he knows how to communicate, knows how to work within a team environment, lead a team. I think those sort of things, whether you can take external aspects of your life and then integrate that into work, I think, you know, there's a definite overlap there. Nice. Is there any other forms of education that you look for in the people that you're hiring, or that you would recommend to other people that are trying to come in into this degree? Anything that you'd recommend to people
in terms of formal education
or otherwise, not even formal, anything that you've seen, anything that you'd recommend to people, hey, whether it be, you know, something from a team perspective or just going out getting their hands dirty?
I think evidence that you've got out there and got your hands dirty is important. That you're a self-starter. You haven't just sat at home and done nothing.
So building that portfolio you mentioned.
Building a portfolio of achievement, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
I can't think of anyone in our team who might have Duke of Edinburgh type awards under their belt, but that kind of thing would be interesting because it shows a particular, you know, aptitude to get out and do something and challenge yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably attractive to any employer, not just to the tech space.
Yeah, I think probably the other thing with you, your teams would be, hey, if they have had that interest and they've done something in that military, you know, way, that it probably shows a certain personality trait, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or they come to us through word of mouth. Someone in our team will say, hey, I've been tracking this guy, he's running an awesome mod on this game that we should speak to him about whether he's interested in coming to work for us.
Yeah.
That's a very familiar story in our business.
They're the best recruits you can make, right? It's a referral from somebody you know.
Yep.
There's proven runs on the board there. So,
nice.
Oh, okay. Obviously, busy man. You're wearing three hats within your company, which is bigger than most people. It's obviously a massive role. How do you get through your day? What's any productivity tools that you use to get through your day, whether it be software related or whether it be just task procedures? How do you get through your day?
In terms of methods of working, I've had to learn to delegate. And that didn't come easy to me. It hasn't been easy for me to let go of responsibility or for the execution of things that ultimately I'm responsible for. But I've had to learn that over the years, otherwise I was just going to sink.
Yeah.
And now I'm more comfortable and really appreciate the value of having great people around you who you can trust to delegate work to. And you have to just let go of the fact that they may get to the end result in a different fashion to you, but as long as they produce the end result, then that's what you need. So that's been a big learning point for me over the past few years.
Yeah.
Because there was a point where I was probably letting myself get overwhelmed because I wasn't willing to delegate and I just had to let go, otherwise something was going to give.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's been a big personal lesson for me. In terms of tools, I'm a bit of a Google fanboy and I've been using Google Keep recently to manage what I'm doing at work. I can keep multiple, it's slightly more sophisticated than just a standard to-do list. Yeah. I can keep multiple lists. I can have subsets and I can link in to Google Docs. I can have links into emails and things like that. So I've been using Google Keep a lot recently to just organize my thoughts and it's that thing where, you know, if a thought pops into your head that you need to do something, or you can just, I can just get my phone out and put it in there, and then it's at my desktop next time I'm there.
Yeah.
So I'm finding Google Keep pretty useful. And I've been trying, but with mixed success, the Pomodoro technique for trying to organise my day. You know this?
I've got the app on my phone. I think it's been opened about half a dozen times. I'll listen to a podcast or I'll read a book or listen to an audiobook and they're like, oh yeah, this is the way to go.
Yep.
Like, I've got to get into this. I'm trying to get out of the multitasking and get into the more focused approaches.
Yes.
So I think one of my problems in the past is just different things coming at me and I'm like, oh, a bit of this, bit of that. Or I'm trying to get, you know, focused area, 20 minutes, boom, in this zone, tick that box. I wouldn't say I'm successful at it at the moment.
No, me either. it's a work in progress.
Yeah, I can definitely see the benefits. And really, it shouldn't be too difficult. It really shouldn't be too difficult to, you know, to section out a half an hour block and be, you know, 25 minutes of this is really, you know, concentrated time.
Yep.
It shouldn't be too difficult. I have found it difficult, though. I think you've just got to train yourself, right?
Yeah. And I think that technique suits some types of work that you need to get through, and it doesn't fit quite so well for other things where you've got to make a bunch of calls or things like that. So it kind of gets disrupted, and then I lose the flow. But
I'm the exact same. Even if I'm making calls for that 25 minutes, that, you know, one call changes the direction, which leads to another task, which and I end up down a rabbit hole. But I definitely see the benefits of it. So there's probably three tips I guess we can share with the listeners. Is there any other software tools or anything? You obviously mentioned Jira before, but that's probably more so for the actual dev team.
Yes, we use, on the non-technical side, we do use Jira because it's there, it's available to us. We do use it for some other things like travel requests tasking.
Yeah.
We put together travel itineraries and put together costings and then have them approved. And we use the Jira system to track all that.
Yeah.
We use Confluence
as
a sort of living knowledge repository. And that's useful for me on the legal side.
Yeah.
So we have a legal resources space in Confluence
where
I can put up a lot of information that deals with frequently asked questions or standard template documents are made available in the Confluence, in our legal space on Confluence. So we use that tool. I've just recently discovered Slack. So the technical side of the business has been using Slack for a while.
Yeah.
And I'm about 3 weeks into using Slack. So that looks interesting. It's got some possibilities.
Oh, definitely. It's probably that consistency again, right? It's if everyone's in there and everyone's using it, it's really valuable.
Yeah.
So there's a mix between that and email and everything else, it can become another tool, right?
Yeah, that's a danger in a tech business where for every problem you reach for a tech solution, you end up with this dog's breakfast of, oh, will you use email for that? We're using Slack for that? We're using Skype for that?
Yeah. So. Very difficult, right? Yep.
Yeah.
And then you've got multiple things living in multiple places. We got something sitting in a Google Drive, there's something sitting in Confluence, but something sitting somewhere else. Oh.
Yep.
You've come from that non-technical background to managing a software company. Is there any books, any podcasts, anything you've listened to, read, that you would stand out as, hey, this is something really beneficial from either a managerial perspective, productivity perspective, a managing teams perspective?
I have to say, I don't use podcasts in that. I tend to use podcasts to switch off.
Entertain.
From work and entertain or get me thinking in another space,
I'll
be honest. So I a couple of the podcasts I listen to are sort of broadly science-based.
Yeah.
There's one that Brian Cox, the UK astrophysicist.
I think somebody else has mentioned that at some point on this podcast.
It's good fun. Yeah, the Infinite Monkey Cage is the name of the podcast. And each week they'll take a scientific topic, and it's really eclectic. It can be anything from natural selection in bees or something really specific to really big questions about physical principles in the universe. And they'll have some subject matter experts and then a sort of interested amateur.
Yeah.
And it's a good mixture of deep dive into really interesting scientific stuff and a bit of lighthearted.
Yeah.
Banter around it, so I enjoy that one for a bit of fun and a bit of thought-provoking stuff outside the workspace.
Yeah. Any others in that space?
If I'm feeling a bit more serious, Sam Harris is Making Sense podcast, but you've got to be in the mood to receive that stuff. The guy is so clear in his thinking, the clarity of his thoughts, amazing. And you can't just kind of idly have that one in the background. You've got to be listening.
Otherwise, I think I've downloaded his app as well at some point. Yeah, I think I got to know him through the Tim Ferriss podcast.
Right.
And he's had an episode or two on there.
Yeah.
Seems like an uber intelligent guy.
Yeah. He's one of those guys you think, wow, you're on the next level.
Yeah.
And I don't always agree with everything he's saying, but his clarity of thought is what is impressive for me.
Yeah, nice. Any books that you've read along your career path that you think, oh, this has definitely helped me out?
Again, I probably use books to get away from from work. Yeah, I'm not someone who has a stack of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People on the bedside table or anything like that.
Yeah.
I guess for things like that, I've looked to mentors and people around me and to learn by seeing what others do and figuring out what's effective.
Nice.
And saying, right, I'll appropriate that for my work practices.
I really like this. So there's obviously multiple ways of learning. Some people use podcasts, some people use audiobooks, some people use books, some people use formal education. You've mentioned mentors. Mentors, I think, is obviously extremely beneficial. A lot of people growing their careers probably don't even think about mentors, right? They'll go to other forms for education. Like, can you give any advice for people to reach out to mentors, to find a mentor, how they can make best use of a mentor?
I think people overthink the idea of a mentor.
Yeah.
They think it has to be some, Luke Skywalker, Obi-Wan Kenobi, master and apprentice type, all-encompassing relationship. It doesn't at all. It can be really informal and just in a specific area, there's someone that you go to. Yeah, there's someone on our team that I will always go to get a better technical understanding. If there's an area where I need some help understanding something technical in our business or generally, there's someone on our team that I'll always go to, because I appreciate the way he's able to explain things to me, and he doesn't mind me asking the dumb questions. So in that sense, he's a mentor for me. He's actually considerably younger than I am. So again, this idea that, you know, the mentor has to be the old grey beard isn't necessarily true. It's just someone who knows
more than you do.
More than you do.
Or has been through a particular situation maybe before you.
Sure. Or who's got a way of approaching things or a way of viewing the world that interests you.
Yeah.
I think if you see someone that you're interested in the way they're doing something, they can be a mentor for you.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say is, now also having been on the other side of that equation and starting to have people ask me either formally to be a mentor or behave towards me like I could be a mentor for them, is don't be afraid to ask. It's actually very flattering to be asked, you know, because someone's saying to you, I think you've got something valuable to offer. So definitely don't be afraid to ask someone to give you some help, to impart some of their wisdom or... And also, just to stress, it doesn't need to be this formal thing. You don't need to approach someone and say, you know, like with an application form and say, you know, can I be your mentee?
Yeah.
You just need to ask for help. Hey, can you give me 10 minutes on this? And that can become a semi-regular thing as you need it. And that's a form of mentoring.
Yeah, nice. I think that's really good advice. I think it's really helpful because it's an aspect of education and, informal education, but an aspect that a lot of people don't really look at.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about it now for the first time probably, but I can see that back through my career, I've done that a lot without even realising it. I just saw people doing things or they possessed knowledge and I was interested in it and I went and asked and said, tell me more about that.
Yeah.
Or I just watched them, observed them at work and said, well, I like the way they're doing that. I'm going to adopt that in my work practices.
Kind of the last part of our sort of podcast here.
Sure.
Got new in-tech people. It's obviously Newcastle focused. I've got a massive, I guess, interest in trying to help grow the Newcastle tech scene. An international company like yours based in Newcastle, greater Newcastle. What's your thoughts on the advantages of being in Newcastle and staying in Newcastle for a company like Bohemia Interactive Simulations?
There's some obvious advantages around cost. The biggest costs in any business are going to be people and space, rent. And if you're going to compare it to any of the capital city markets, Newcastle's a heck of a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So that's giving you straight away a bottom line advantage.
Yeah.
We're located here because our founders were from this area.
Yeah.
But it suited us to stay here. We haven't seen a strong... reason to we haven't seen a strong pull to Sydney or even to further afield to Melbourne or Brisbane or whatever. You can sell Newcastle well to people, I think.
It's
an overused term, but it's that lifestyle thing that I think is pretty attractive.
That sells becoming easier, I think, with opportunity as well.
Yep.
I think in the past there might have been a lack of opportunity. There's always been the lifestyle, but lack of opportunity, a company like yours is growing. Opportunities that you're able to provide within your team probably weren't there, 5 years ago, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, when I first came into this role, we had a small wood panelled office above a fish and chip shop in Nelson Bay.
Yeah.
At that time we had 4 or 5 people.
Yeah.
And so now we're 14 in Australia. The opportunity is there, has grown for personnel growth, and we've matured as a company now. So we're at one of the new buildings out at Williamtown, that tech hub that's there next to the McCure Hotel.
Nice.
And that in the defence arena is it's quite a powerful hub of businesses that are collected together there.
Definitely.
And it doesn't seem to show any signs of slowing. I think they're about to break ground on the 5th office building over there.
Yeah.
In that precinct that we're in. And the airport's looking at plans for a business park on some land that they have on the other side of the airport. Nice. So, you know, there's various things happening. The airport is only one hub, but that's where we're located. So I'm seeing a lot of that. And so there's a real, there's a lot of growth happening there.
Yeah, well, I think people don't even understand, right? Like, because unless you do drive out there, people don't understand that growth. People see, you know, Newcastle CBD, the growth and the changes happening in there. But there is that, let's call it Greater Newcastle, that is, you know, continuing to grow a little bit, you know, just outside of your daily view.
Yep. And some a lot of that's defence related, and a lot of that defence related work is high tech stuff.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get it, but not everyone does. The having the deep maintenance base for the F-35 aircraft at Williamtown it's going to be a big catalyst. In that defence precinct out there and for Newcastle generally, the number of jobs that's going to drive and high-skilled technical roles.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to recruit from outside the region. There's no way that...
No.
I was speaking to the head of BAE Systems who've got the sustainment contract for the F-35 aircraft.
Yeah.
And the numbers of people they're going to have to recruit over the next sort of... 1 to 5 years to meet their requirements. They're going to be bringing a lot of people in from outside the region.
Definitely, which adds to, you know, the local economy. It's great. I think that's where a lot of growth, especially it's happening in the tech scene, where obviously creating opportunities for graduates and you know, younger people coming through, but also creating opportunity for bringing other people back to Newcastle, you know, skilled, highly skilled people to Newcastle, either back to Newcastle or to Newcastle for the first time.
I was going to say that back to Newcastle it seems to be quite a prevalent theme. A lot of people who've gone away to go to university and find perhaps their first job opportunities, they're now coming back to Newcastle.
Yeah, with skills.
Yes, with skills and experience. And I think there's a real, from what I see in the events I go to and people I speak to, there seems to be a real groundswell of interesting tech businesses in and around Newcastle.
Yeah, there's definite growth there.
Yeah. But I think maintaining the tech community is really important. It's part of why I wanted to do the podcast. I think having that, because a lot of the businesses they're small, they're startups, they're two or three people, or they're sort of casual in nature, but they've got really good ideas and really good businesses, you know, burgeoning. But I think there's an opportunity in a market like Newcastle to create a real community around that, which adds value on top.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm no different to you guys. Obviously, you mentioned a team of four in Nelson's Bay to where you are now at 14, and 14 is a substantial team, right?
Sure.
First four, and that growth only happens through, you know, obviously some smart people to begin with, but adding and building upon that.
Mm.
If we see more and more of that happening, I think, you know, the whole community in the tech scene grows as a whole.
Yeah, and I think with things like smart cities and the investment coming from the university, there's a real opportunity. I mean, it's already happening to an extent, but to build the reputation of Newcastle as a tech hub, there's definitely opportunity there for that.
Completely agree. Biggest challenge you face being in the Newcastle market?
Skills. Finding people with the right skills that are already here. So we often, when we're looking, we're having to look outside Newcastle and attract people here, which is fine, you know, that's great, but it does make it a little bit harder. It would be easier if there was a bigger mobile pool of talent in and around the Newcastle area.
Yeah. Completely agree.
Infrastructure is the other one. We're paying much more than we really should have to get a decent internet connection where we are. So things like, because we can't get the NBN out there.
Yeah.
They don't consider it a priority. It's
even with that business hub.
It's a technology park. And I have to say, it's through no fault of the developers out there. They just, the NBN are, their response is poor. And so for a long time, we struggled out there with a very average internet connection.
Yeah.
We've been able to get one now, which is a bit better. We can get about 300 megasecond download now, but we're paying more than we really should have to for that.
Yeah.
So that kind of infrastructure is frustrating, and I can't help wondering whether if we were in Sydney, we might have got a better response from the NBN.
I dare say that would be the case. Mate, is there any other commentary you'd like to sort of share on the Newcastle scene?
Yeah, the idea of I think Newcastle is of a size where that ability to have a community that can get together and do things above and beyond just individual business interests, that Newcastle is of a size that could really accommodate that. I live in Nelson Bay, so sometimes it's hard for me to get in for Newcastle events, but I try and come in for events and volunteer to speak or to try and do a little bit for that community. But I think that's a real opportunity for everyone who's involved in the scene. So I don't know, I just encourage people to get involved in that because I think it can add value for all of us.
Yeah, nice. Hey, people that'd like to get in touch with you, people that might have heard something that really sparks their interest today, is there any which way you'd prefer them to reach out?
Yeah, professionally, probably LinkedIn's the best place to find me. I use LinkedIn a lot. A lot of our customers use LinkedIn, so I'm on LinkedIn a fair amount. So, yeah, just find me on LinkedIn, Ryan Stevenson.
No problem. Thank you for your time today.
Okay.
Cheers, mate.
Good to talk. Thanks.
Thanks again for your time. Today marks episode 20 of Newly Tech People, so thank you for all our listeners. If you want to catch up on any of our old episodes, please visit www.newlytechpeople.com.au. Thanks again.